Hey, hit the bank.
Just as we get ready, I want to warn you not to go to sleep. You know what happened to Eutychus.
He also was resuscitated.
Yes, and he died again. Now, I want to resume slideshow. How do I do that?
Just probably hit the enter. No, we get rid of that little cross at the top.
That little thing. Hit the wall.
Hit the wall.
It's a great privilege to be with you this morning. I bring greetings from the Mount Pleasant Uniting Church, which starts promptly at 9:45-ish.
Can we turn the lights up?
I like talking with stories and pictures. If you're listening to this on audio only in a few days' time, tough luck because you'll miss out on most of the images. So I'll try and describe those as we go. Ross said about 20 minutes plain talking, 20 minutes discussion, 40 minutes total, something like that-ish. We'll see how we go. The next series of slides are a puzzle that I want you to ponder and see what they mean to you, and I'll show you them again at the end and tell you what they mean to me. The wall. A blank wall and a lot of little dots next to it. The wall, and one dot moves. The wall, the dot moves closer to the wall. The window, the dot is close to the hole in the wall, which is a window. On the other side of the window, there are bright coloured rainbow dots. Two dots move close to the dot on the wall side, and there's a connection. It becomes a door. One dot moves through the hole, through the door. The door closes and we're back to the wall. What does all that mean? Here's a photo that you may recognise, you may not. Do you like this piece of art? Fairly fancy. Any art critics here who can tell me what this photo is? Picasso. Do you know what it's called? Picasso had very special names for his paintings. This one's called, very provocatively, Nude, Green Leaves and Bust. If you look very carefully, it's got a nude, some green leaves and a bust. And that was sold for $106 million US, so don't laugh. But at the age of 16, before Picasso became a Picasso-like painter, he was just an ordinary painter who painted realistic scenes. And this one, this amazing picture he did at the age of 16. That's not like Picasso, is it? You wouldn't pick that as Picasso. What does it show? He called it science and charity. The science is the doctor. Doctors in 1897 didn't have a great deal to offer, except a stern look and a touch on the hand. So he's offering his science. He's concentrating on technology and the pulse. On the other side is charity, which we would prefer to call love. And the love is portrayed by a Catholic nun who's holding what is presumably the child or grandchild of the patient in bed. It's a hospice deathbed scene. And the patient who's dying is surrounded by a combination of science and charity. What have we done since 1897? The first thing we did was get rid of the stupid old woman. We rubbed her out. We got rid of charity, religion and all that rubbish. We kept the doctor. We added more science. High-tech intensive care, drips, machines, we've made this really high-tech. Is that a better death for that patient? We thought so for 50 years or so. But the last 20 years has seen a change of thinking as doctors and nurses have realised that a dying person needs more than technology. And so they've brought charity, they've brought religion, they've brought spirituality back into the picture. My view is that a dying person needs both science and charity. The science is pretty good. We've got a lot of technology, medications, theory, x-rays. But the charity, the love, the spirituality, the religion, is still a bit unsure, a bit uncomfortable. Royal Perth Hospital hosts the CPE program, the Clinical Pastoral Education Program, to train chaplains to learn how to sit with people who are sick and dying. And some of us doctors recognise that this is highly desirable. So that's my mission in life. My deepest mission now is to persuade the medical profession that healing has a spiritual dimension. It's not enough just to be physical. Here's a pictorial illustration which I made up, and I call this the healthy person's world. It's dominated by work, and work is employment or housework or homework, whatever fills your day. There's a house and a car and travel, there's health that's of some concern, and right down the bottom there's family and spirituality. For many people this lies dormant. The worldview changes when you get sick. Health becomes more important, and people suddenly become more concerned about their family, their children, their future, and they start wondering, what's it all mean? So spirituality becomes bigger as well. What happens when they face death? This is my concept, that people lose interest in money and houses and cars. They become very focused on family. They worry about the son that went to America 20 years ago. They worry about the brother that they're alienated from. And they start looking at family reconciliation. And they start asking, what about the meaning of life? Is death the end? So deep spiritual questions. And I would simplify that by saying, at the end of life, we realise that what really matters is relationships. And there are two sorts of relationships, human and divine. At its core, our Christian faith is about relationships with God and man. You just sung Psalm 23. Have you ever noticed the change in the personal pronoun for God? I hadn't until my friend Alan Chappell pointed it out to me 40 years ago. In the first three verses, God is referred to as he. It's a distant relationship. But when we face the valley of the shadow of death, when things are really grim, often people experience a you relationship. You are with me. God becomes closer. And after a terrible event, people can often say, I thank God for that. It changed my life. I have a new perspective. A woman says, I thank God for my breast cancer. It's transformed my life. And some people would say, you're crazy. That doesn't make any sense at all. And yet it seems that suffering is essential for spiritual growth. I'd like to ask you, this is the first bit of interaction. Think about where you would like to die, if you have ever thought about that. And I'll give you three choices. A hospital like Royal Perth Hospital, the best hospital in the Southern Hemisphere. in the world. Fantastic hospital. Or a hospice. The Murdoch Community Hospice in St John's. Beautiful institution. Or the Claremont Bethesda Hospital. Wonderful hospices. Or your own home. This is an involving congregation, so hands up for hospital. Hospital number, vote R0. Right. Who'd like to die in a hospice? Quite a few people. I think that means you've seen them, you've recognised the value. They're great places. Who'd like to die at home? Just a slight majority for home. I'd say home was 15 votes, hospice was 10 votes, hospital was none. And six people didn't vote, they don't want to die. Well, there's no right answer. In Perth, it's possible to die at home quite well because we have very good home care services. But if you don't have a home, or if you don't have a family to help, it's very difficult to die at home. Now for a harder question. I'd like you to choose your sort of death and give you two choices. Would you rather die very suddenly and unexpectedly? So next Sunday you come along and they say, by the way, Fred died last Sunday night. What? Is that the kind of way you'd like to go? Or would you like to die slowly over some months? I'm going to ask you to talk to the person next to you for 2 minutes and say what you'd like to have and why. It's my little break and you can talk, and I'll interrupt you in 2 minutes, okay? You're on your own.
Yeah, I am.
No one to share your choice of death.
Yeah. I'm just thinking. I've always thought suddenly, but actually our experience with Michael's mother's death, I think slowly and predictably, is quite nice.
It's got some advantages, hasn't it?
Sorry?
Has some advantages.
Yeah.
There's plus and minus for both.
Yeah, there is, absolutely. Yeah, from the... There was a lot of time to say things and experience things, and as a family it was a great experience. But then there's that slowly and predictably from something that's not in a great deal of pain, slowly and predictably from something that's pretty awful for the dying person. For me, that would not perhaps be so good.
A nice slow death.
A nice slow death.
Right, time's up. Put your paper down, put your hands on your head. That was quite a successful exercise. People are still talking. I'll just go away for half an hour. Pay attention, please. Pay attention. Coming back to the meeting. It's sort of time to stop-ish. Linda and I had this all worked out. We decided that a nice, slow death was the way to go. A slow death gives you a chance to get ready, but we don't want a nasty slow death. Well, this is not a nice joke. The only way you can choose is to suicide. Okay, otherwise you don't get a choice. Well, I guess, you do get a choice. When you're frail and dying and sick, and the doctor says, let's try an operation, let's try some chemotherapy, let's try some dialysis, you can say no. You can decline modern Western medical therapy, which may be good or maybe just prolonging your life. There's definitely a tendency for the Western medical profession to do too much. One thing, I hadn't got this in my script, but I would say, if you're pondering your death, write an advanced care directive. This is the law that came out last year in Perth, that said you can write down, when I'm frail, sick and dying, I want this or this or I don't want this or this. And you can say, I do not want to be in ICU. I do not want resuscitation. If I'm paralysed and unconscious, I do not want this and this to be done. But it's very hard to imagine the 1,000 ways you could get sick. So the easiest choice is to say, when I'm sick and dying, unconscious, get my daughter Mary to decide for me. You have to choose Mary carefully. If you don't have a Mary, you can choose your next door neighbour. And the person you choose has absolute legal power over everybody else in the family and over the doctors. It's a very powerful choice. So choose carefully. As long as you're conscious, you can override your own choice, of course. We're not treating you. You said here you want to die. But I want to be getting better. So it's for when you're unconscious that advanced care directive takes effect. So you seem to be tuned in. No, I can't see any Eutychuses now yet. I'd like to point out a fundamental concept of the difference between curing and healing. Curing is what we do to diseases. Pneumonia gets cured. Many diseases, in fact, we don't cure. Arthritis, we don't cure. We just keep it going. Diabetes, we don't cure, we just treat. But doctors are trained to cure and to treat. The longer I practice medicine, the more I'm swinging towards the idea that I want to be a healer. And healing involves making whole. Suffering people need healing. Here's my Google series of icebergs. This Google iceberg is the visible outside one, the top stuff that you see. And for doctors, I tell them this is the stuff that you do to people, like treat their pain and treat their vomiting. It's what you're trained to do, and you have to get it right. You can't have a deep conversation with someone who's vomiting in pain. But having got this stuff right, there's still more to be done. And this amazing Google photo of a real iceberg underneath, they tell me it's about a kilometre deep and it weighs a billion tonnes. That's the deep stuff. And I use that to illustrate there's a psychological, emotional part of us. At the deepest part, there's a spirituality. Many people now say, I'm not religious, I don't go to church. But I would say everybody is spiritual. To be human is to be spiritual. And it's the concept of life that you have, the framework for living. Everybody has that. It's what makes you who you are. It's what holds you up. If that's not there, the iceberg sinks. So it's really important to tap into the deep stuff. My hero is Balfour Mount. Professor Balfour Mount started life as a urologist, that is, a kidney surgeon. I guess he was about 30 when he went through a life crisis, and he thought to himself, I'm not really satisfied doing this stuff. I don't want to do another 1,000 kidney stone operations. I want to deal with the meaning of life. He was a devout Christian man. He heard about Dame Cicely Saunders in London, and he went to meet with her and came back to Canada inspired to establish palliative care. He's the undisputed leader of palliative care in North America. This is the quotation I'm most fond of. Healing is a relational process. Healing has to do with the relationships between people. It involves movement toward an experience of integrity, integration, making whole, which can be facilitated by a caregiver. That means a doctor or a nurse can help. But it's not the doctor or the nurse that does this stuff. Healing is something that comes from inside the person. It depends on an innate potential within the patient. And it doesn't require getting better. You can be healed and still have your cancer or your broken leg or your heart attack. And there I've deliberately put that in red. Indeed, it is possible to die healed. At first sight, that's a contradiction. You can't die if you're healed. But I'm talking about the fact that we're all going to die, and I would like for every one of my patients to die healed. That is to say, at peace, integrated, free of fear, forgiven and forgiving. That's what my work is really about. Dame Cicely Saunders was the founder of the hospice movement. Again, a devout Christian woman who went to St. John's All Souls Langham Place, where John Stott was the rector. She was first a nurse, then, like many nurses, she hurt her back, couldn't work, and became a social worker. She had a passion for caring for dying people whose care was inadequate and suffering and in pain. She was a dominant woman. She was campaigning and saying, this is no good, this must be fixed. And her friend said, Cicely, calm down. You can't do a thing. You're only a social worker. Only doctors have power. So at the age of 30-something, she said, well, I'll do medicine. So she's a qualified nurse, social worker and doctor. They went on to be a ferocious. Can you be ferocious? What was the other word? Massive. No. I met her. She was a fearsome woman. Huge, heavy built, solid, terrifying woman. And she bulldozed Parliament and the medical profession. She said, the hospitals are hopeless, I'll set up my own. So she built St. Christopher's Hospice in South London. It's not really attractive, I wouldn't say that to her. It's not by the snow or the waterfalls. It's four rather ugly, can I say, levels of building. But it's the world centre where everything happened. It was the founding hospice of the world. But they did research to say pain can be controlled, emotional issues can be dealt with, spiritual issues can be addressed. And she was a driving force worldwide for getting hospice care recognised. She certainly recognised that spiritual issues were central. So in her new hospice she said, I want a chapel. At about the age of 70 she married for the first time, and she married Marion Chios. Josko, I might have got that wrong. He was a Polish art professor. She saw his paintings, bought the painting and married the artist. So he, at the age of about 80, used to go to work every day on the top of the hospice, where he had a studio, and painted these wonderful paintings which adorn the hospice. So this one on the right is the birth of Christ, the centre is the crucifixion, and the left is the ascension to heaven. These beautiful works of art adorn St. Christopher's hospice. I'm sure Dame Cicely was one of the quiet workers, no, she was never quiet, forceful workers in WHO who said, we want to get a world health policy, that this is what palliative care is. It includes the spiritual aspects. This gives me an opening when I go to the College of Physicians to say, are we training our palliative medicine specialists in spirituality? And some say, what? And I say, well, that's what palliative care is. And our constitution says we address it. So that is actually my last goal in life, is to write a curriculum for training spiritual care for specialists in palliative medicine. I draw on the work of my friend, Reverend Dr. Michael Wright. He did a PhD study interviewing dying patients in Britain and asking them, what's really important now that you're at this stage of life? What matters? He wrote in his final report that hospices began in a Christian environment, so he expected to find spiritual answers from Christians. But what about Muslims and atheists? He said non-religious patients have the same needs as religious people. And these are the four things they all want. They all want love, meaning, forgiveness, and transcendence. People have asked me to do talks and workshops and to train them in spiritual care. So I often use this as a model and say, if this is what patients want, let's do a workshop for an hour on what does love mean? Let's do another hour workshop on what is meaning in life? How do you find meaning? And my favourite is forgiveness. The one thing that I think people need when they're dying is forgiveness. That's what stops integration. It's bitterness. One of the hymns today was something about let me be able to forgive my foe. And that struck me as very powerful. Love your enemies. Pray for those who use you poorly. And forgive your enemies. This is Jesus' hardest teaching. If you had a terrible marriage and been divorced, if you had a terrible daughter who's had fears and run away from home, you've been ripped off by your partner and abused, if you've suffered intolerable stress, then the safest thing is to forget about it and just push it away and deny it and just go on with life. But it still smoulders there. It's my experience and my theory that all of us has a little black box inside that says, painful memories, do not open. The trouble is, in the last month of life, when people are reflecting on their life and when their mental senses are becoming a bit slow, these nasty memories somehow pop up. And that's the time when people think, I really want to forgive my wife, my brother, my child, my father. I want to forgive my father for abusing me sexually as a child. That kind of sexual trauma, personal abuse, betrayal, these things really wound us. What are they really? They're broken relationships. Relationships need healing. The stupid thing is that we wait until the last month of life. Why not do it now? Because it's horrible and painful and costly and unpleasant. So we'd rather put off the nasty stuff and think, well, I might deal with that one time. When the time's right, I'll deal with that nasty relationship. But right now, I'm going to lunch at Bobby's house. And we're going to have some sport, and I've got kids to look after, and I'm busy. So I find in my work that I sit down with the patients and say, tell me about your family. I don't say, who are you married to? Because people don't marry anymore. I don't say, who's your husband? Because it might be a lesbian couple. So I found the polite way to ask is to say, you live at 4 Smith Street, Mount Pleasant. Who lives at that house? And I make it open-ended, and they say, well, John and Mary and Jill, and what relationship are they to you? Well, he's my first husband, he's my second husband, she's my first child. And I try and draw this network of people with strange families. Is there anybody else important? Well, there's Jean. Jean? I didn't know about Jean. Who's Jean? Well, when I was 17, I got pregnant, and Jean was a baby, and I adopted her out, and I haven't seen her for 40 years. I'd really quite like to meet Jean. And so 40 years later, at the end of life, that's the big challenge. We have to find Jean. And I think, why didn't you look for Jean 20 years ago? But this is what death's all about. It's about closure, about healing, about forgiveness. And it's about families. I don't want closure with Bill Gates. He might be the richest man in the world, but I have no relationship with Bill Gates. And on my deathbed, I won't want to see him, or Julia Gillard, or Kevin Rudd, because they are famous figures of no importance whatsoever to me. But I would want to see my wife, and I want to see my first wife and my current wife, because I've been divorced, and I've been through the pain and the forgiveness and the healing. And I now feel totally forgiven by and have forgiven my first wife, Christabel. And I can now feel comfortable talking to her and approving of her and praising her. But it took me 22 years to reach that stage of forgiveness, because like many Australian men, I'm a slow learner. This is my friend Chantal Chow, who is the leader of hospice care in Taiwan. She did a PhD thesis interviewing dying Taiwanese patients and said to them, what's important? And she came up with a very similar answer to Michael Wright. She drew it in the form of a diagram where people said, what's important to me is to be deeply connected to myself, to internally understand who I am, to be deeply connected to my other friends and family, to be connected upwards vertically to, she called this, the higher being, because in the Buddhist culture they tend to refer to a higher being rather than God, and to connect with nature. So that's another simple model that not only when we're dying, but as we're living, we want to have connections with other people, ourselves, God, and the environment. 2 weeks ago, we had a tears speaker, Andrew Broadbent, talking about shalom, the Hebrew concept of shalom. And he said shalom means total healing, peace, integration with yourself, with other people, with God and the environment. So that was a new insight to me, to say, well, this is the old Jewish concept of shalom, deals with these same four dimensions. I'd like to say that integrating with oneself is perhaps the hardest, because people don't understand that. Integrating myself with myself, that's nonsense. I'm me. At least for an Australian academic male like myself, we men don't often look inside. Women are better at that. We just think, I'm a farmer, I'm a plumber, whatever I am, I do stuff. But we have feelings, emotions, deep thoughts, and fears, and hurts, and pains, which we don't tend to talk about. So looking deeply inside through psychotherapy, meditation, etc., can be very helpful for Aussie men. I'd like to show you the picture of two different concepts of a death. This person dying is in Royal Perth Hospital. The person is a 21-year-old lad who has leukemia. He permitted me to take the photo, but he said, I don't think I look very attractive. I'd like you to block out my face. So in the bed is a 21-year-old dying of leukemia. He's in what we call the bone marrow transplant unit on the top floor of the hospital. It has views of the river. It's a lovely room. But I'm not so sure about this view here. The nurse saw me, took the photo and said, you should have come yesterday. He had 9 intravenous pumps running yesterday. Today he's only got 6. Our team was asked to help this lad because he was in excruciating pain. Sometimes leukemia can be very painful. When the leukemic cancer grows inside the bones and stretches the bone marrow, it can be terrifically painful. But a 21-year-old dying in hospital of leukemia also has suffering, has existential pain, has anguish, has fear, and that magnifies physical pain. I show this picture deliberately to fourth-year medical students because they're all 21 years old. And I say, how does that feel to you? how would you like to die in that room? And of course they feel horrified. It doesn't feel like a healing environment. The only healing thing in that room is the CD player. And the day I walked in first, there was music playing, and the song playing was Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound. It was beautiful, it was poignant, and it seemed out of place, this high-tech stuff and this sort of desperate little hope to get the spirituality. I'm going to contrast that with another photo, and I want you to look at this next photo and ask yourself, how do I feel about this image? What is the emotion in that picture? You can start talking.
Connection.
There's a powerful connection between the old couple. Where is the place? Is this in hospital? In fact, it's a hospital bed, but it's in the patient's home. The man is 92 years old. He was in Fremantle Hospital, very sick, and realised he was dying, and given the choice, he said, I want to go home. So his family got equipment and oxygen and took him home for the last week of life. And in that last week, his 23 children and their spouses and their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, every one of them came except for a granddaughter who was in the US. So they're able to say goodbye. To me, this is not the picture of someone dying. This is the picture of someone living. Someone surrounded by love. Someone connected to people. I find it hard to tell this story because he was my dad. The top right is my son Jono, who's now Warriuka Scripture Union staff worker, 6'4" and very tough and massive. At the age of 13 he was very cuddly. Of course I get emotional. This was 5.5 years ago. You only get one dad, and the death of a parent, male or female, is very powerful and should be, because it's the loss of a human relationship. No matter what your theology, no matter what you believe about life after death, there's something awful and sad and grieving about losing a parent or a spouse or a child. So let's come back to this series. What does it represent? What's this series mean to you? What's the wall? The wall is death. The wall is the barrier between this world and the next world. And the dot is a person moving towards death. I've chosen to represent it as a window because it's a common experience of a dying person to have a vision and to say, I can see my father or my grandparent. I can see the angels. I can see Mary, the mother of Jesus. And the person, people in the room, people outside can't see anything. Only the person dying is able to see through the window. At the point of death, this world and the next world touch briefly. And it's quite a common experience for the dying person to experience a relative coming to guide them through the journey. But then once they've died, the people left behind look around and say, well, this is it. They've gone. We're back to normal. And they can easily dismiss the fact that there is a heaven, there is another dimension to life, there are other worlds. So many people would say, this life is all there is. I've lived a good life, I've never hurt anybody, I've enjoyed my life, and when I die, that's it. But for a Christian, we'd say, no, there's a lot more to it. I'd like to share two brief Bible passages with you, two favourites of mine. The first from Jesus on the cross, when you recall that one thief said to him, if you're really Jesus, get us down. And the other one said, no, don't talk like that. This man's innocent. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And what was Jesus' reply? Today you'll be with me in paradise. Today, what an audacious thing to say. That man had not been baptized or entered a church membership. He never made a donation to the church. He didn't know his theology. He didn't even know what denomination he belonged to. He didn't know the theology of resurrection. But he had some awareness that there was a new kingdom. And Jesus had promised him, today you'll be with me in paradise. I don't want to debate the second coming of Christ or the end times or purgatory. These things are mysteries. But I do take seriously the words of Jesus to one person, today you will be with me in paradise. This is a photo of the cave in the island of Patmos where the Apostle John had the vision of the revelation. From the second last chapter of the Bible, last chapter, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with us, with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. Some of you might be saying, my uncle's dying this week, my neighbour's dying next month, and I see them and I don't know what to say. How should I talk to them? They may not be a Christian. How do I convert them? We get quite worried about how to communicate with a dying person. To give them a Bible and a whole stack of Christian scripture readings may not be helpful. And in my practice, I don't often give scripture readings. But some patients say to me, doctor, would you pray for me? And I certainly ask them, are you the kind of person who would like to talk to a chaplain or a priest? Oh, I haven't been to church for 5 years. That doesn't matter. Would you like to talk to somebody? And often they would. And if they occasionally ask me to pray for them, I've had a Buddhist man and an Islamic person say, please pray for me. So I say, well, I will be praying from a Christian perspective. Is that all right? Yes. Then I'd like to pray for you the prayer of the Old Testament, of the Torah, the prayer that God told Aaron to use, Aaron the first priest. And the prayer is, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. That's called the Aaronic blessing. It was what God said to Moses. Moses, tell your brother Aaron to bless the Israelite people with this blessing. So it's totally acceptable to Jews, Christians and Muslims. And I think it's acceptable to all people. I don't have an answer to you if you say, how do I care for my relative and my neighbour? What should I say? I guess my main advice would be to say, listen, just don't stay away. Ask them, can I help you? How are you? Do not say, I know just how you feel. I've been through this. I know just how you feel. Because you don't. Even if you've had a near-death experience, even if you've also had cancer, you've also had a heart attack, you have no idea how they really feel. And it's patronising and insulting to say, I know just how you feel. In fact, I deliberately say the opposite. George, I really can't imagine what you're feeling. I don't have to say any more. And George will say, then that opens up and the person starts to tell you. And when before Jesus died, the night before he died, he went out into the garden. And what did he say to James and John? Just watch, just be here. Don't talk, just keep me company. So presence and company and connection is what's needed. Words are not needed. That's enough. How's the time going? We're sort of out of time, but if I'm, I can go as long as you like. Discussion, questions?
Thanks very much, Doug. We're going to have a finish with Amazing Grace, the song.
Terrific.
You're staying around.
Yep.
And going to join us at Bobby Peter's place for lunch too. So
free feed.
Like to have a chat with him, please do so. Thank you very much.